Hey, everybody. J.J. Cooper, Jeff Ponson, our Baseball America Prospect Podcast. And we are recording this 2 p.m. roughly Eastern on Tuesday, which means that less than 12 hours before this, Jeff and I were both still up watching that game. We'll talk about it a little bit at the end of the show, but we're watching that 18-inning monstrosity of a beautiful train wreck of exceptional disasters and so many things happening and all that. But so the thing I'll start before we jump in, we are starting a Fix It series on this week's Prospect Podcast. Next 4 weeks, we're going to look at systems that are far away or have been far away and kind of what we think they can do. We're going to start with the Nationals. But before we do that, Jeff, I just got to ask you, how are you holding up? You, like me, stayed till the end, watched till the end. And I believe you, like me, also had to get up this morning, which
not really. I'm very lucky that my wife is up early and did not stay up for the game. In fact, she fell asleep during regulation. That's the way I'm going to put it. During regulation, before exactly. It was probably like 11. And so she kind of let me sleep until like 9 o'clock and took the kids to school. And, there you go. My youngest son did make an appearance in. So like my office is like in the basement of my house where we have TV and like kind of where I'm recording right now. And so like it was 1:15. I thought everybody in the house was asleep but me. And then all of a sudden Nolan comes chugging down the stairs. Like, Dad, what the heck is going on? Which then woke up my wife, which she then realized about 10 minutes in that it was 1:15 in the morning and not like 11:30. And then was like, yes, you need to go to bed. So I think he missed the final 4 or 5 innings because it went till 3 a.m. So he missed the final hour and a half or plus. So, yeah, I was up and got a few hours of sleep. I'm doing okay. I had an extra cup of coffee this morning.
That alarm at 7 a.m. this morning, it rang loud. It rang hard. And, at some point, I probably will take a nap before the game tonight, hopefully. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're not going to talk about the World Series tonight. We're going to talk about really the question we're trying to phrase today is how can the Nationals get back to the World Series? Something that they did not that long ago. It feels, I'm sure, like forever ago to the Nationals fans. But 2019, the Nationals are on top of the world. They win the World Series. They do what every Nationals fan had dreamed of. And if you were really an old timer in the DC area, maybe even what you were dreaming of the Senators doing many, many years ago. But since then, the Nationals have like the rebuild of the Nationals has been long and so far utterly ineffective. They went to the basement the next year in 2020, but that's 2020, 26 and 34. We'll give them a pass on that one. But ever since then, 65 wins in 21, 55 and 22, 71 and 23, 71 and 24, 66. And I think that's the one, obviously, that is the one that is that was the last straw, because obviously Mike Rizzo and that front office is out. And now we have a new front office, the hiring of Paul Taboni. They have made multiple hires already. And I would say that you could say that there is a definite Red Sox feel, like that there's bringing other Red Sox officials other than Paul Taboni are coming over, which again, what normally happens in situations like this is when you leave, you're given like a number, right? Like, okay, you can take X or you can take so-and-so and so-and-so, but you're not allowed. No organization is going to let you just say, okay, they're all coming with me, but obviously there often is this, you can bring someone to be a top lieutenant or someone who's clearly getting a big promotion to the new, in the new front office, things like that. But that kind of leads us into, so we're going to look at first the national strengths as they stand right now. And then we'll get into the room for improvement and the things we would suggest that they need to improve. But so, Jeff, to kind of start that off, I would say that this new front office the Paul Timoney front office is kind of right now, would, you know, this, it is to be determined, but I would say that you could anticipate that that has a chance at least to be a strength. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at the group that's coming over, whether it be Timoney, whether it be Devin Pearson, you know, who is also involved in, you know, was leading these Red Sox drafts over the last couple of years, where they've been able to build a pretty strong pipeline first to position prospects, and then seemingly overnight kind of turned into a pitching heavy system, something that we really had never seen previously. And, you know, then, you know, you look at Justin Horowitz coming over from the Pirates, who was there for a couple of years, you know, had previously been in a position, you know, in amateur scouting with the Red Sox, I think was maybe like a special assistant to the director or one of those sort of titles. His first draft with the Pirates, of course, they land a number one prospect in the entire game in Connor Griffin. And they didn't land him at like 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. They did land him, you know, in the top 10, but at the back end of it, pretty good pick. He's got some track record as well. They're a team that does well, a group of evaluators, I'll say, that does pretty well at identifying players in the amateur market that can then make a jump professionally. And we'll see how they set things up internationally and how that structure will change. And then I think also they're an organization that understands how, you know, some synergy and complete and clear lines of communication between departments, particularly the acquisition side of things, whether that's scouting, whether that's analytics, R&D, or combination of all of those with player development is really, really important. And I think particularly on the Red Sox side over the last couple of years, they've seen how that's worked on hitting and on the pitching side. And, you know, how just having consistent messaging all throughout the system and spring training and then utilizing technology and information to make more informed decisions in player development, I think could really, you know, uncover a lot of low-hanging fruit for the Nationals, just because, as we talked about before the show, generations-wise, it may not even be the upgrades that we've seen recently have success in terms of the Red Sox pitching development or the Blue Jays, each of, I think I've written about this year. They were probably a little bit further along in terms of when they had to improve than the Nationals are at this point. So there's probably a lot of low-hanging fruit and things that they can upgrade process-wise, technology-wise, coaching-wise, etc.
Other thing I would say that's the other current strength, and we'll see where this goes with this, is that a lot of the teams we're going to talk about, these four teams we're going to talk about, there's a number of teams I would say we're going to talk about where you will start with saying, like, we're going to talk about the Rockies. And the Rockies have very few players on their current big league roster who you could plausibly make the argument are going to be important members of a successful big league Rockies team. I don't think you can say that with the Nationals. You can say with the Nationals that they have a number of relatively young players who have at least shown something. Now, they may not have all synced it up at the same time, but Jacob Young, we'll work our way up, not the stars first, but Jacob Young has shown he's a very good defensive center fielder. Now, is he good enough to be a regular? Maybe, maybe not. But even if not, he's a very good fourth outfielder. I would say that you could say that Luis Garcia, been around a while now, but he is someone who has in his best years been a plausible starting second baseman. I think that you can say that Brady House, with improvement, he's got real power. Maybe he can be a third baseman for you or a first baseman for you. Dylan Cruz has been very disappointing in the big leagues, but this is one of the best college baseball players of the 21st century. CJ Abrams has been a above average shortstop at his best. And James Wood has been a all-star level player at his best. You have like Keibert Ruiz, maybe you can get him back to being a regular at catcher who's at least adequate. All these things are like potential building blocks. Or the other way you could go with this is, it's a new regime. If they want to say this rebuild failed and we're not close, there also then are a number of players here who would still have value to, if you said, hey, we're going to take two steps back to take three steps forward, there are players here that you could get value for and trade if you wanted to. obviously Mackenzie Gore on the pitching staff would be probably the most prominent of those. But so there's ways you could go with this. There are pieces here, but there's still a lot of work to do, as you would expect for a team that has been basically the basement of, I mean, the Marlins are in this division and the Nationals have consistently been worse than them in the 2020s. And the Marlins, I would say at this point, are significantly probably further along, crazy enough, in their rebuild than the Nationals.
This episode is brought to you by Square. Your favorite neighborhood spots run on Square. Square is a proud partner of more than 4 million neighborhood businesses around the world. These businesses are what make the neighborhood the neighborhood. You and I are both in Orlando, and I see Square all the time at those awesome farmers markets around town.
And a lot of restaurants in general just have this, to where you just, they have the little thing plugged into their phone and you stick your card in it and wham, bam, we're out. It's cool. It's a way for local businesses to make money and make it easy on not only them, but also on me, the consumer, because Lord knows I'm not making or selling anything.
No, and it's a tap or on your phone. You mm-hmm. double click.
You can even insert your chip if you want to, swipe it. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's changed the game. You can go to square.com/go/foul to learn more. But before you do, go support your favorite neighborhood spot. You'll be happy that you did. Again, square.com/go/foul to learn more. Square, see you in the neighborhood.
Get after it, FT fam.
That gets us into it.
I will say that I do think that, you know, a lot of the players you just named off, they probably have more high-end guys than the Marlins do at this point. The Marlins have gotten a lot more consistency from their players that are maybe a tier below than the Nationals have gotten from Gore, from Wood, you know, certainly from Cruz, but Abrams. But like Abrams, Gore, and Wood, that trio has all shown – well above average to plus potential in the major leagues for month to multiple month stretches, but they've also had really low lows in the same season on the back end. And I think that lack of consistency is a problem.
And that is the perfect, you set it on a T there, Jeff, because the perfect, our number one suggested fix is this team. This is an organization that needs better major league baseball player development, not MILB here. We'll get to that, but MLB, because what you just said, this is the Marlins, I would say, are an organization who you can say they had multiple players in 2025 who performed at what you would say is at least their 75th percentile of what they can do in the major leagues, right? They had guys who you're like, I didn't know he could do that in the major leagues. Or they took players who maybe were at one point, Xavier Edwards, who was like, okay, this is an intriguing prospect, but had kind of grown a little stale. And then they're like, come on over here, X. And when they came over, he's taken a step forward. Jacob Marcy. There's a number of guys that we could point to and say they've gotten the most out of those guys. I don't know how many Nationals you can point to and say they've gotten that player to his close to what he can do. There's a lot of players who you could say, if this is close to what Dylan Cruz can do, then that something went horribly wrong, because Dylan Cruz, and we can, I think we're both now on more a little bit on the skeptical side. I think we both would describe Dylan Cruz more as a very good complementary player likely than a star, but he's got a lot of work to do to be a good complementary player right now. James Wood with better contact is a star, but 220 strikeouts in a season is going to means that you're having months where you're just not producing at the level you need to, even if you are showing power at times and all that. CJ Abrams getting consistency. Like we said, all these players we're talking about, there is a lot of, can we optimize these players more? Can we get more out of them? And it does not mean no organization bats 750 doing that. But I would say that the Nationals have batted, you know, their batting average on getting adequacy to significant production out of their best young players on a consistent basis has been lower than the batting average for most organizations. That's kind of how I see that one. I want to kick the next one to you, Jeff, because this is one that you're really onto, which is drafting and developing college arms, which is something also that goes back to something, as you just mentioned, that the Red Sox have done. Why do you lay out that that's something that they need to do better and need to really work on?
Well, I think what we're seeing, consistently. And I don't even think this is necessarily a new thing, but I do think in some ways it's been kicked into hyperdrive as the minors have shrunk. Pitching injuries have grown. And the length of a lot of those injuries and the return time has grown. So there's been a greater need for a lot of college arms to move with just greater immediacy. And I think when you look at the Nationals, particularly at the top of the draft, and even this year, you know, there's no real college pitching. They didn't take a college pitcher until round seven. And while you can hit in round six through 11, I'll say, on some college pitchers, and anything from 12 to 20, I think really if you get any sort of major league value out of a college pitcher at that point, it's great. Not a lot of like college starters that turn into major league starters are coming out of those rounds. Not that it's unheard of, but it's obviously less likely. Rounds one through five is really where you're finding those guys. And it doesn't have to be your first pick, as we saw, you know, with the Red Sox a couple of years ago, landing Peyton Tolley. But, you know, over the course of a few years, I think you do need to go after some of those college starters. They're the guys that are getting to the big leagues a lot quicker. And especially the guys that are early in the draft, whether it's Chase Burns, whether it's Treya Savage. Paul Skeens obviously is one, but he's certainly an outlier. We talked about Peyton Tolley. Nolan McClain is another one that wasn't a first rounder, right? But, you know, was somebody that after more or less a year in the minors was really able to make that jump to the big leagues. And, you know, honestly, if the Mets wanted to, they probably could have done that even earlier. And, you know, when I look at the Nationals drafts, I see a lot of hitters in the early rounds. I don't see a lot of college pitchers with upside. And even the ones that they have, like they took Jackson Kent a couple years ago in 2024 in the fourth round. He had a pretty good year for them. He moved pretty fast for them. And obviously he had less expectations than others. I think when you're an organization like this, where you do have some hitting talent, you know, you can find those guys in comp rounds. You can even take one still early in the first round, but you do need to probably commit at least two to three picks in the first seven rounds on college pitchers. And, you know, it will take a few years, but you have the potential to really hit some homers if you do that. You know, have some rotation pieces or rotation depth, as well as trade assets that you can move to reinforce whatever is needed in your team at a given point in time. But, you know, they really haven't gone after college pitching over the last 5 years or so. The last draft where they really did that pretty consistently, I think, was the Cavalli draft. Though I guess they did take Jake Bennett in the second round in 22 or 23.
22.
That was 22.
Yeah, but they took Jake Bennett in the second round, but in a draft where they took Elijah Green in the first,
exactly.
Trey Lipscomb in the third, Brenner Cox exactly. in the fourth, and Jared McKenzie in the fifth, and Nathaniel Leyva in the sixth.
Yep.
So, like, yes, they did take but they took one pitcher in the top 200 picks that year also.
The holidays can sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Goods has a host of unique, high-quality, and often handmade gifts, many of which are crafted by independent artists and small businesses. That attention to detail often means products are made in small batches, so the best finds can sell out fast, like the book of famous Dodgers newspaper clippings ordered on Uncommon Goods that I received as a birthday gift. It was a special present catered to my liking that can't be found anywhere else. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, and diehard baseball fans like me, to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're not only finding the best and most unique gifts for the people you care about, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice and have donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/BA2022. That's uncommongoods.com/BA2022 for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Yeah. And, you know, it was the same in 2021 where it was House, Lyle.
Ray Bossier. It was Dustin Sines.
Yeah, they took Dustin Sines, who was like, you know, an undersized lefty who's lifted at 5'11", but is probably like 5'9". So it's just, they're not taking sort of these horse guys that maybe have traits and attributes. You're like, all right, this, you know, Pete Toy was at TCU and was a two-way guy. And, you know, we know we can do this and get him on this program and probably add some velocity. They're not doing that sort of thing. I think it's probably pretty easy to say, hey, we have people in place that can identify those guys now. It's just a matter of getting, you know, the right people in the positions and personnel and player development to kind of execute that. So I do think, you know, that's one area where the Nationals could put some draft resources toward in the immediate, you know, next year or two, and probably see some pretty quick turnaround wins.
So number three is emphasizing developing better contact skills for the Nationals' young hitters. Focus primarily on the minor leagues here. Could be said to the big league level too, to some extent. But so the thing that is a little bit worth digging into here, we have at Baseball America, and I'll put it in the show notes for this, the StatCast hitting rankings for all 30 organizations. And one of the things that does stand out for the Nationals, and it is not a surprise that the Nationals rank best. Their best ranking is they are second of all 30 orgs in 90th percentile exit velocity. The Nationals do not have a problem with having players who hit the ball hard. That is what they have selected. That is what they've done. That is what they've developed. What they've had a real problem with is getting those players to hit enough, to make enough contact for that power to really play and for that power to matter. And the key thing that really does jump out about this, though, is this, it's not swing decisions. Often you would see with that, it would be like, okay, they're bottom of the barrel in swing decisions. Their chase rate's really high. And you would say, okay, so what we're going to have to do is really work on making better swing decisions, you know, understanding pitch recognition, getting better at that. They're 11th in swing decisions. That's fine. That's not a giant flaw. Their giant flaw is they're dead 30th in contact percentage and they're 29th in zone contact percentage, which I do think is actually a more challenging hurdle because you have these players who have real power and make adequate swing decisions, but they can recognize a fastball or a breaking ball in the zone that's where they want it to go, you know, where they want to hit, and then they swing and miss. That's where it's like, okay, some of that's going to be, some of these players is going to be like, hey, I'm sorry, but we can't fix this. But you're trying to like, okay, I would say that you are looking at, as you bring in, as you try to help your hitting instructors develop these players, you're kind of looking at trying to reduce length in swings, trying to clean up things as far as setup. Like if you have a player who's particularly noisy and it's like, hey, this bat waggle means you're late, you know, like looking on timing, things like that. That's where I think that they've really got to make a point of emphasis. And this kind of goes to maybe also they have to steer a little bit towards, hey, we got to bring in some more players with bat to ball skills and then develop their power. We're going to put them on bat sweep program. You want to have a little bit of a mix, I would say, Jeff, of all this, but like they've gone too far in the big power, big swings, beatable in the zone. And I would ask you before we move on to the next one, which is a little bit related, how easy do you think that is to fix? Is that something that you're going to have to kind of go to your next wave of prospects, or is that something that you think is fixable?
I think it's going to be on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, once again, I know we've kind of beating this drum to death. I sort of feel like it's going to come down to player development and who is in place in player development. If they have, you know, a history of this stuff, if they've had success, if it's the right message for this group. Some of that's probably going to be taking inventory of the type of things that were taught and focused on. Because I can't necessarily say that the Red Sox have had great success in terms of improving contact and swing decisions. They've tended to draft guys that already had a really good foundation of that and then try to build up bat speed is, you know, sort of been what the focus is. So I do think that some of the targeting is probably really going to change going forward. That said, not everybody that's in this organization is probably fully lost. And quite often when we see improvements in player development, I think we saw it with the Cardinals and we saw it with someone like Josh Baez, where some processes and folks have changed, obviously, as Bloom was kind of put in charge of improving processes before, you know, he took the top job there. And, you know, you see somebody like Josh Baez make a pretty significant improvement year over year. And I'm sure there's guys like that. It's probably not necessarily Elijah Green based on how bad that contact is. But, you know, if they could get him to a point where he's Spencer Jones, I think people would be pretty excited about that player just because of what his defensive ability is. So I think, like, the fact that there are EVs there, I think is maybe hinting at some low-hanging fruit that maybe not all these guys are going to turn to something, but if there's guys with impact that maybe we can improve how they approach their at-bats and their plan at the plate and kind of attack swing decisions like that and hopefully hack contact by improving swing decisions, you know, maybe we see better results for these five out of this group of 15 that had these good EVs but kind of crappy everything else.
Number four on this kind of segues very nice with that. Like you said, you mentioned Elijah Green. It's Elijah Green, it's Brady House. Even on the college side, it's guys like Trey Lipscomb, where it's like, okay, there's real power here, but there's length to the swing. There's questions about contact ability. I think that where the Nationals are right now, you do have to ask the question if you're coming in as the new regime and say, hey, do we need to kind of course correct here a little bit? Do we need to approach this a little differently? Because this is an organization that is, I would say, overweighted towards big power, big swings, swings and miss. And I am not telling you right now that if Elijah Green had been drafted by another organization, none of these problems would have arose. But I will say that was probably the worst combination I can think of player and organization, because the Nationals have not shown that improving contact ability has been a strength of theirs. That's been kind of a consistent issue for them kind of year after year after year. And Elijah Green, who to this day, when you talk to evaluators, when you talk to scouts who scout Elijah Green, they will tell you really good defensively, can really run, real power, 10 hit tool. Like, it's the combo where it's like, none of this can play unless you can get to a baseline of contact. And Elijah Green's baseline of contact has been 40 to 44% of the time he will step to the plate and he will walk back to the dugout on a strikeout. And no player, you just can't be a successful player if you say, I have to do all my damage in 55 to 60% of my plate appearances because the other ones I'm striking out. It doesn't work for anyone. But it's not, again, it's not just Elijah Green. Brady House fits into this in some way. There's a number of players where they've kind of emphasized that approach. And I think that they would need to, at this point, I would say it's fair for the new front office to come in and say, is that an approach we want to continue right now? Or to kind of go to your college pitching, you know, side, is it a little bit of a time to kind of emphasize more contact and athleticism and defensive skills to kind of leaven out some of this? But that leads into our last point. And this one is the one I think that is the most obvious, but it's also the one that has been the biggest, one of the biggest problems for them in the 2020s, which is when we say, okay, so the Nationals were a, you know, we're a great team in the late 20 teens. They won the World Series. And you say, okay. And part of that is, hey, if you draft Bryce Harper and Steven Strasburg 1-1 overall, you won the lottery twice. And I don't mean because you picked them. I mean because they happen to have the number one picks in years where Bryce Harper and Steven Strasburg were available. And let's be honest, the Bryce Harper year, like if they had gotten it, quote, wrong, it still was like, okay, do you want Manny Machado? Okay, that's fine. You know, so they did that. They traded for Trey Turner. Great move. But on top of that, they then also, they traded for Adam Eaton, was a useful, very useful play for them. But I would say that, like, on top of that, this is an organization that did spend money at that time. This is an organization, Patrick Corbin, that money didn't always work out but they spent big money for Patrick Corbin. They had Max Scherzer. They re-signed and, you know, extended Steven Strasburg. This was an organization that was spending big money at that point on Bryce Harper, but even before he left in free agency. They had all, you know, free agents like that they brought in as an additionally, like, you know, again, not Kurt Suzuki was a ton of money, but Kurt Suzuki, veterans like Howie Kendrick, they spent money. And here we are in the 2020s. If you said, what is the biggest, most significant free agent signing that the Nationals have made? Let's just say since they traded Juan Soto, you really wouldn't have a whole lot of candidates to spell out there. Again, yes, they have. I'm not saying that they haven't signed any free agents. Yes, they did bring in Nathaniel Lowe. Okay. They've had guys like that there, you know, briefly in some cases, but that was not a major signing. If you were going to, like, okay, so let me ask you this way, Jeff. Would you spend the money right now? You know, okay, they also signed Josh Bell last year, who had a good, you know, was fine for them. But would you spend the money now? Or is this something where it's like, is the time to spend the money to bring in some guys to kind of go around this young core now? Or is it better off to say, we're not that close? We're going to spend money, but we've first got to rebuild this a little bit to even know where to spend the money first.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question. You know, I do think that it depends on, you know, what they decide to do at the major league level. Because we did talk about there are some pieces here. You know, whether it's, you know, the combination of Wood, Cruz, Abrams, Garcia. I think Dalen Lyle proved to be at least a good platoon player, you know, at worst. if not something maybe a little bit better, you still have Mackenzie Gore. You do have Josiah Gray, who's had moments in the big leagues coming back. Mitchell Parker, who not great once again, but probably fine as part of your rotation depth. I mean, if you wanted to go out into the marketplace and, you know, shop for another outfielder on a reasonable deal, I think especially with the current market that we've had over the last couple of years, we're outside of the top tier free agents. A lot of guys are sitting on the market a little bit longer. A lot of guys are signing bridge deals for a year at a high number, right? To then kind of rebuild value, get back into the marketplace. I don't think that they're in such a bad position if that's the direction that they want to go.
Okay, so you talked about the maybe a veteran outfielder. And I do think that there's going to be available outfielders at a reasonable price. But so here's the kind of the core question to wrap this up with. Gore, Gray, Luis Garcia, you've got two more years right now before they're free agents, right? You've got the 26 season, you got 27. Then CJ Abrams, you've got, he's a free agent in 28. You can obviously try to extend some of these guys, but that's kind of, I would say, like part of this core. Do you think that this team, I would say it's a big leap to say that they're going to go from sub 70 wins in 25, having not won 75 games any time this decade, to going to a playoff contender in 26. But is it realistic to say that they should be spending to try to make this team a contender before those guys hit free agency? Or is it more realistic to say your goal is 27 and 28 and maybe some of those guys have to move to try to build towards that 27-28 window.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes more sense to probably sell some of those guys. I do think that selling Wood in particular would be like a terrible idea.
You've got to have some stars.
Yeah. And I think you probably, you know, you would stick with Cruz and see where that goes over the next couple of years. I mean, I wouldn't be necessarily against potentially trying to hammer out an extension, you know, with Mackenzie Gore. He's going to be 27 years old entering next year, kind of going into prime years. If you feel as if, you know, there was some issues with player development at the major league level, he's potentially a guy that you know, you could see on the upswing. On the other side, he's never thrown 170 innings over 4 years in the big leagues. And obviously has had some health concerns, you know, leading up to that point as a minor league player. So, you know, there's probably some question as to whether it's even a sound investment because you're signing him, you know, probably for, you know, his age 30, 29 to, you know, 33, 34 sort of years. You have to make a determination if you think he's going to make that jump. It's possible he does. I mean, that is when starters seem to kind of hit their peak. It's not necessarily at 25 or 26 or 27, like you kind of see with hitters. They kind of go into that window in the late 20s. And then I think, you know, those years in the early 30s, if they're good starters, typically are prime years as well. So age-wise, it's not necessarily an unsound investment, but I think you can look at some of the history with the player and say, is this ever going to be a guy that's going to give us 180 to 200 innings a year and be, you know, an ace for us, which is probably how I would assume he's going to want to get paid.
So that's our look. That is our prescription for how to try to fix the Nationals. I would say to wrap this up on the Nationals that it's a project, but at the same time, we will definitely talk about organizations that have further to go, right? There are pieces there. Like, I would say that probably you just hit on it. The big thing is if you can get James Wood, the starting point of any team having a great team is to have a star, an honest to goodness 5+ WAR every year star. And James Wood has a chance to be that. If you could say that James Wood can be a 5 WAR player, and between CJ Abrams and Dylan Cruz and Brady House, we didn't talk even about, but the other strength of this is there's some injuries to it. But between Harlan Susanna and Travis Sikora, who's obviously injured, and Alex Clemney, and bringing back Cade Cavalli, who came back last year, there are some pieces here on the arm side, too, that could contribute, could be a part of the next good Nationals team. There are pieces here, but there's also a lot of work to do. So that's kind of wrapping up our fix-it segment of today. But before we go, we are baseball fans. Yes, this is the Prospect Podcast, but Jeff, the World Series so far, the playoffs so far have been wonderful, but the World Series so far, like I felt like this is going to sound weird, but like we love prospects. Seeing Edgardo Henriquez come into that game last night and they're like, we are now in the point where the Dodgers are in the dregs of their pen. And then seeing him go out and just shove with 102 was very fun to watch. To see kind of these players kind of, you know, that we've kind of been following over the years, obviously. And then there's like Shohei Ohtani who reaches base 9 times and all. But what has stood out so far as we record this before game 4, which you'll be hearing this after game 4, but we're recording it before game 4. Sorry, we're not staying up till 4 in the morning to update this because we did that last night. But what has stood out from the World Series to you so far?
Yeah, I mean, just been really competitive games. You know, I guess game 1 wasn't necessarily so competitive, but
it was until it wasn't. I mean, It was like back and forth, and then like, whoa, what happened here?
And it's an explosion of offense. I think the last two games have been, you know, close fought contests where it seems like for 3 or 4 innings, you're kind of on the edge of your seat waiting for like there are a couple guys get on. All right, is this the swing that's going to change everything? We sat for 10 innings last night, pretty much from the 7th inning on until the 18th, waiting for that swing to happen. And it seemed like Freddie Freeman had a few of them, if I'm being frank. the Dalton Varsho was very busy in center field because of Freddie, and he had a couple of nice barrels that, you know, just didn't fall. Finally, the last one in the 18th inning, you know, gets over the wall in center field, and, you know, we're here now. But I think the pitching for the most part, outside of that game one, you know, in terms of the Dodgers bullpen and kind of that last inning with Snell, has been really good. Great execution. You know, you get a all-time pitching performance out of Yamamoto that, you know, offsets a great pitching performance from Gausman on the other side. I feel like that's happened to him a few times this playoffs. But yeah, and then you go in tonight and we're going to get to see the full Shohei Ohtani show after one of the most brilliant World Series performances of all time. And, you know, there's a entire podcast we could do just on Ohtani's performances within the last week. I think that's maybe the most remarkable part of this. And I think it was something that was in my head last night as I was watching an 18 inning game for the second time in the last 7 years or whatever, because I did stay up for the last one. Was Red Sox Dodgers in 2018.
Nate Eovaldi's time to shine.
I didn't feel like I was watching, though, like the same type of game I was watching last night, a sense that there were Hall of Famers in both lineups. There were Hall of Fame pitchers we saw got to throw for both teams kind of at the end of their career in different roles. We saw an all-time great player having an all-time great performance. And, you know, maybe a turning point in this series where we're not going to see many at bats for Shohei Ohtani going forward. But overall, it just, you know, the moments have been great. Especially as you get from the sixth inning on, it's really felt like there's been, you know, I'm looking for the right word here. Yeah, totally drawn a blank.
We're both exhausted. Let's just be clear.
Yeah, exactly. The drama, you know, I think, and that intrigue, like, you know, there's just, such an intensity from the sixth inning on in all these games. And we've even seen good bullpen performances from, I mean, I certainly didn't expect, but 9 shutout innings from the Dodgers and Blue Jays bullpens combined, but that's another thing that we got last night. So pretty remarkable, you know, game overall. And tonight's game, I'm sure will be good, but probably not like that. I think that's,
I am hoping for 9 innings tonight. Yeah. I will say
what if we get like 12?
I did not stay up for the 18 inning Red Sox Dodgers game. And I've had regrets. Like, I can't even remember what it was, but I remember like in the 11th inning of that game being like, I'm exhausted. I have to go to bed. And that was one thing I'll say. The other thing I'll say about one of my loves about the pitch clock, because the games don't take as long.
Yes.
I am sitting here at the very end of October, and I'm not in the sleep deficit that the postseason used to put me in. Like, having one game go till 3 in the morning, 2:53, I think, is when I said on Slack, good night, everybody. So, like, for a game to go that, but the other games be ones where I'm in bed before midnight, and in some cases, like 11:30, it's not the same thing as if you're pushing it till 12:30 night after night after night all through October. And then you get to here and you're like, I'm already so tired. And then this one game popped up. So I was thrilled and relieved. I would have, if the sun came up in on the East Coast and that game was still playing, I was going to be watching it. There was like, nope, you are not going to, I am not going to miss a second chance at kind of the crazy game that you'd never get to see in the World Series. But the other thing that does stand out, there's a couple pieces at baseballamerica.com that I will recommend. Obviously, like I said, we're recording this before game 4, but Ohtani already just obviously set the record for most times reaching base in a game, period. Not World Series record, not playoff record, just record, which is amazing. But I think it's also remarkable that as we sit here right now, after 3 games, he was sitting at a 1.417 slugging percentage. That is, if he keeps that up, that would be the second best of any player in a World Series, you know, 15 or more plate appearances. Most bases, and I say bases, that's total bases plus walks plus hit by pitch. He's got 23 after three games. Again, you'll know a little bit more, but I'm assuming, I can't imagine there won't at least be a couple of walks in tonight's game for Ohtani. Only two players have ever had more than 30 bases between all that in a World Series. Wow. He's on game three games. Like, it seems very likely he hits one more homer and gets some walks, he could get there. That would be, one homer and three walks, and he's at 30. That would put him in the top three all time. Barry Bonds, 35 in 2002. Whole lot of, I think it was six or seven intentional walks in that year is the record for that. Most home runs in a World Series, he's at three. Three by itself is like, okay, that's nice. But there have not been many players that if he hits one more, he's in a tie for fourth most in the World Series. George Springer, Chase Utley, Reggie Jackson, the only players to hit five home runs in a World Series. And if he gets to actually hit, if they don't just keep walking him, five doesn't seem outlandish at all for Shohei Ohtani to get there. And the other one that we just mentioned, Barry Bonds had seven intentional walks in that 2002 season, World Series. Ohtani's already sitting at four. He could easily potentially get to there. And he has a .667 on base percentage. That puts him in the top 10 all time on base. Although Billy Hatcher had an .800 OBP in 1990. That's hard to beat. And he's got a .500 batting average, which puts him in top 25 best batting averages in a World Series. All of these things could change if he has a bad night. But it's worth noting one other stat I wanted to share. If you go to baseballamerica.com, I just love this one. I know I talk about it a lot, but if you're watching this postseason, like I talked about it a little bit, we talked about that Edgardo Henriquez, Henriquez and Will Klein come into that game for the Dodgers, and neither of them had pitched. Klein hadn't pitched since the regular season. Henriquez had made one appearance in the wild card round. Neither of these guys are like, oh, these are guys that are guys that the Dodgers trust. These were break glass in case of emergency guys. And they come in, and they came in immediately throwing harder than 99.99% of all pitchers who've ever thrown in the big leagues. Klein was touching 99, and Henriquez was touching 102. And that's the perfect summation of baseball in 2025 and why it's so hard to hit, is that the pitchers who they're like, nope, we're not going to use them unless we have to, guys, are guys who throw 99 or harder. The stat with that, there's another piece over up at baseballamerica.com. This postseason still could, as we record this, there are at least two, and there could be as many as four games to go, already has had more pitches thrown 95 miles an hour than any postseason in the pitch tracking era. And I could say with that, I'm sorry, anyone who believes that actually velocities were they've increased since 2008, but before that, they were actually way higher than they are now. No, I can feel comfortable saying most ever in a postseason. We've seen it at 95 miles an hour, 96, 97, 98, 99, 100, 101, not 102. A world of Chapman 2016 by himself means that there's more 102 miles an hour pitches in 2016, but 103 and 104. We have seen more pitches at, I would say, what we would describe as premium velocity, like the 98 plus and all that, than we saw in the 2008, 2009, 10, 11, 12 postseasons all combined. 100 miles an hour, 98 miles an hour. There's more pitches at those velos. And by the way, the other thing with that I find fascinating is we have seen now we are in the era of the 93 plus mile an hour breaking balls, the sliders, the Jacob Mizorowskis and others who are throwing stuff like that. That didn't exist. That did not exist just like a couple of years ago. The pitching, the velo, the stuff in this postseason has been remarkable. It kind of helps explain a little bit why we have 18 inning games. Although I think you can also explain a little bit by that you got to the postseason, got to the extra innings, and the Blue Jays were down to basically of their best hitters, Vlad Jr., and everyone else seemingly was out of the game because there was no Kirk, there was no Springer, there was no Barger. Not ideal from that standpoint, but just so much to kind of chew on, digest, and is fascinating about this. We will be back next week. I think next week right now, the plan is that our Fix-It series will turn to the biggest project. We're going to look at the Colorado Rockies. We did the Nationals first. We know what the Nationals front office is looking like. Maybe by the time we record this next week, we will know what the Rockies front office is going to look like, but we will have some fix-it suggestions, and I'm kind of using that as a way to kind of point out kind of the strengths and weaknesses of the organization. I think that's the one we're going to do next. The other ones we have on the docket to do, we're going to look at the Pirates and we're going to look at the Angels as well. So we hope you're enjoying this. If you do have thoughts, or if you want to suggest another team for the Fix-It series, you can leave a comment or you can send us an email at podcast@baseballamerica.com. For Jeff, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.